Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, aka an album that sizzles. But today, we are going multimedia with a new series where we talk about music and movies. We're calling it Music and Popcorn. Shout out to Morgan for coming up with that. And we're kicking it off by taking a trip up north to the Santa Cruz Boardwalk and taking a creepy escalator down into Jordan Peele's 2019 film, Us. If someone in 2016 had asked for your opinion about Jordan Peele, you might be forgiven if you had first asked, wait, was he the tall guy or the short guy from Key and Peele? Prior to his breakout debut film, Get Out, Peele was best known for his comedy skits alongside partner Keegan-Michael Key. But with Get Out, Peele showcased all manner of talents as a screenwriter and director by crafting one of the most lauded horror-slash-thriller films in recent years. In 2019, Peele was back with Us, a dark and at times darkly funny meditation on race, class, inequality, and the lethal shortcomings of voice-activated smart devices. Peele clearly has mastered the art of creating a tense, creepy atmosphere, not just visually, but orally as well. And we may never hear the Loonies' I Got Five on it quite the same way again.
Indeed. Us was the movie and soundtrack pick of our guest today, Renee Beaver of the podcast Attack the Queer Wolf. Renee Beaver works in the social services and crisis intervention sphere, lending her love and her support of queer communities right here in my beloved Los Angeles. She's been here in LA for 8 years, as she reminded me. We met 8 years ago today. We got to know each other a little bit better when she reached out on social media and said, who wants to pick me up from LAX? And I said, I do. And the rest was history. I rolled out there and I was like, how you doing? My name is Morgan. And the rest is history. She is super talented, a visual artist, a writer, and a fierce voice in the community. She's part of the trio of hosts of Blumhouse's Ultra Cool podcast, where they discuss movies with shriek-worthy moments of horror and mayhem and present a very lit perspective on them. I'm so happy to have her here in the box with us. Welcome, Renee, to Heat Rocks.
Hi. I think it's funny that 8 years ago, when I was very new to LA, I would ask someone to pick me up at the airport, and now I would never
ask anyone.
See, yes. It's because you did not realize the hellhole is LAX.
So. Man.
Yeah.
Man. And because I'm from here, this is my hometown, I was like, she ain't knowing. So let me go on up there. Because LAX, like he said, it's tough. Mm-hmm. And there ought to be a horror movie just about LAX, getting in and getting out of that.
That'd be too real.
Oh, man. So, Us. Why Us? Why'd you pick this one to talk about?
Well, it's definitely my favorite film of
2019. Ooh.
Nice.
And that's not to say I saw all of them that came out this year.
Sure.
Because I did not. But yeah, it's my favorite.
Why?
It's visually stunning. It's fun to watch. It's fun to listen to. It kind of like scratched some kind of deep fear itch I had.
Really?
Yeah. I just felt really moved by it. And it was just like felt so good on my eyeballs to stare at so many black people.
Yeah.
In a horror movie at the same time. It was just wonderful.
And I went to see it with tons of black folks. I mean, it was black deep in there. When we came out of the Cinerama Dome, it was like being at an HBCU all over again. It was filled with black people. And one of the things that I liked about it was, to me, how black the movie was in its commentary on race and class. And we can get a little bit more into that.
Just to back up a second, I'm wondering, especially because this is obviously the follow-up film to Get Out, which I think took a lot of people by surprise. The expectations were super duper high for Us, and I'm wondering, for The Room, what were people's expectations going into the film, and then did it meet or exceed those expectations?
For me, it exceeded, and I know that that's not necessarily the most popular opinion from folks. But to me, Get Out was a movie that obviously meant a lot to Black folks, and at some level could be understood by white people as well, or just anyone, really. And I felt like in Us, it takes like a certain amount of a marginalized identity to feel it as deeply. And so I think if people that learned a certain lesson and Get Out, a lesson that they didn't know, then they're probably not somebody that would have felt something deeper from Us.
Sure. I think one of the things that stood out to me the most was, well, first of all, I had great expectations because Get Out was just such an experience. And again, I went to see it on opening night. It sort of gave me a new feeling about horror. The joke had always been, Black folks always die first, okay? You know, we just don't have a presence in horror movies. I've said before, I always wanted to music supervise a horror movie because I thought the music was always creepy and it would be an opportunity to do unusual choices. And both in Get Out and this, I thought the choices were unusual but elegant. So my expectations were high, and it lived up to it in every sense of the word.
Overall, I thought Get Out was better executed. And partly it's because I have a lot of very small nitpicks with the plotting of Us, perhaps not the least of which is the only thing stopping hundreds of millions of underground murderous clones from rising above an escalator that just goes down the wrong way. Like, I'm just trying to figure out the security layout of this whole thing. Spoiler alerts, I suppose, if you haven't seen it yet. But I did think that that comparatively, Us, and maybe this goes back to your point, Renee, I thought it just had a better overall level of sustained, those kind of thriller tense horror moments. Whereas Get Out felt a little bit more up and down. Really, once you get into the, this shit is really creepy, it just holds that, and it holds it really well throughout Us until I think the very end.
Sure.
Not to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but the song that he chooses to, that Jordan Peele chooses to close the end scene with, I think just sort of changes the mood in this really fascinating way. But again, we'll certainly get much more into that. One of the other things that struck me about both Get Out and Us are the ways in which Peele sort of understands the drapings of what a middle-class aspirational lifestyle looks like. And I think he really hammers that point home on Us because you have that kind of the little bit of class envy going on between the Black family, the white family, but everywhere everything's nice looking. The cars are nice. The houses are really nice. But then, you know, he's revealing all the sinister sides that lie beneath it. And I thought that, and this is not obviously unique, I think, to kind of horror as a genre. It's always playing with these kind of expectations. But the ways in which I think, and this goes back to what I was saying about just the look of his films, is he knows what looks good to us, for those of us raised with kind of those middle class aspirational ambitions, but he's pointing out, like, yeah, I mean, it might, that's the veneer, but let's like kind of dig a couple inches beneath that, and you see what lies beneath, both in literal and figurative ways, right?
Yeah, indeed, and that the suburbs are more scary than the hood, and that once you achieve that certain thing, you have other sorts of worries. And I like sort of the juxtaposition of the white family versus the Black family.
Right.
It all played out to me on the beach scene, where, you know, the inside joke around that Black people always tell us, white people let their kids go crazy. They'd be out there and on the beach, the white family, you know, they weren't talking about the kids. The son goes missing and Lupita Nyong'o blacks out. Later we know why. Yeah, I think it's a little bit of commentary on parenting, on the different styles of parenting.
Oh,
it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but a little bit like, this is what we say about you guys, that you guys let your kids run wild, however true or not true that is. I thought it was a little bit of a nod to that. And a little bit back and forth about the have and have nots when, and I forgot this character's name, but he's teasing the father about having a dinghy. He's like, well, what kind of boat did you get? Did you get that dinghy? And his whole achievement is buying this boat, which is, you know, it's a sort of a bucket.
Yeah, right.
But it's aspirational.
Right, you know
what I'm saying?
It's not
quite a yacht. But it's not quite a dinghy.
Right.
It's somewhere in the middle, and he's so proud of it. But there's a little bit of prodding, like,
oh, yeah. Oh, no, that's...
We ain't got that.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
not even that subtle. I mean, it really is.
We ain't got that, yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really like how, you know, it starts out with this Black family, and it's like they're going on vacation.
Yeah.
They have this spot, and they're at the beach, and up against this white family who's actually rich, who has like glass walls and don't lock their doors. It's like, okay. And that's really interesting because I think as a young person, I would have thought both of those families were rich.
Sure.
And not until much older would I have understood how much richer the white folks were.
Sure.
Because I would have thought that anyone with a vacation home or a spot to even go on vacation were wealthy.
In Santa Cruz.
In Santa Cruz.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would have thought so, too. Mm.
Let's start shifting this to talk about some of the music and sound of the film.
Sure.
And in particular, one of the things that I thought was really cool is in the lead up to Us is that Spotify had given Jordan Peele, I guess they have this takeover series where they allow filmmakers to take over part of the playlist section within Spotify. And what Peele did was he built his takeover around a discussion of the use of music primarily in horror and thriller films. For example, here is his breakdown of the use of Goodbye Horses in one of the key scenes in Silence of the Lambs.
Normally, when a horror villain is introduced, particularly one who makes dresses out of human skin, the music is foreboding and ominous. Q. Lazarus's emotive, new age Goodbye Horses is anything but that, and yet it fully establishes the creepiness and mystique of Buffalo Bill's character in a matter of seconds as he dances in front of the mirror.
It's surprisingly hard to find this series of commentaries by Jordan. Like, if you search in Spotify's own search engine for Jordan Peele and Takeover or Jordan Peele, whatever, it doesn't come up. You find it through Google. So I like Spotify, like fix your algorithm. I don't, because it actually is a really fun listen. He doesn't overstay his welcome. These are really short bits. But just to have someone pointing out, oh, look at this film, look at and how it uses this song, I just thought was a really useful and educational and entertaining way of rethinking, again, what is it that we're hearing and listening to a lot of these things?
Sure.
And again, from a very personal perspective. I'm just wondering, for each of you, do you have any favorite uses of pop music in a horror or thriller?
This isn't a use of pop music, but it was one of my favorite uses of music in a film, and it goes back many, many years ago to an old black and white film called Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Mm. It's Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, and if you're not up on the story, Bette Davis is the worst possible sibling ever, but she's also a child star, a really old child star that's stuck in the past. And her claim to fame was her persona as Baby Jane and this one song that she used to sing all the time. We catch her, she's in her, I guess you'd say 60s, and she's still got the blonde ringlets and the little Cupid doll face. And there's a scene in the movie where a guy comes over to check in on them. Baby Jane's, you know, she's shot out mentally. So she thinks it's a talent agent come to, you know, recruit her for some. So she goes into the song and she performs it. You have to imagine the creep factor of a woman in middle age, still with blonde ringlets, thinking she's Shirley Temple, and doing this whole sort of song and dance in the house with a man who's, for all intents and purposes, some sort of social worker and is like, oh my God, right? That was one of the moments, hearing her do that song and them sort of showing flashbacks of her being a little kid doing the song is something that I will never forget. And it made me think differently about celebrity and what celebrity fading does to people who are clearly dependent on it. So that was a moment that I always thought, this is what it's like to be stuck in the past.
I've written a letter to Daddy. His address is heaven above. I've written, dear Daddy, we miss you and wish you were with us to love.
What's funny is the first thing that really came to mind as you were describing that is that in 2019 or 2020, that person would be on a reality show just trying to perform that song, you know, which would maybe
exactly.
take some of the creepiness out.
Exactly. You know? What is that show where they all live in one house together?
What, The Real World? Or?
No. It's like the
Bad Girls Club.
Exactly. No, they live together. Is it Big Brother? No, that's not the name of it.
Yeah, I think Big Brother. That was like one of their, yeah.
They live in the house, yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like maybe Celebrity Big Brother. So that was a moment that I never forgot. That little, it was so scary in that moment to watch her Be Frozen. It's a commentary on a lot of things, on mental illness, on elder abuse, on celebrity and stuff, but I'll never forget that moment.
Yeah. I thought about, and this is something that Jordan talks about in that Spotify takeover, but it's in Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead, and it's the use of Queen's Don't Stop Now during the pub attack.
Mm.
And, I mean, if you watch enough of Edgar Wright's films, you know, he is one of the modern masters of strategic use of pop songs in films. And I think because Shaun of the Dead was, and I don't remember if this was his debut film, it was certainly like the film that, for American viewers at least, this was the film that introduced us to his style. And just the kind of, I mean, the song is played both ironically but also done brilliantly along with the cinematography and the editing in particular, because everything happens in the scene on beat with the song itself.
Sure.
And I just wanted, I wish I could have been in the room when the surviving members of Queen were shown the scene and then asked if they were willing to clear it or not and what that discussion would have been like. Because it's, I mean, it's a funny scene. It's a kind of effed up scene. But the use of like the super cheery Queen song for the zombie attack,
sure,
is the juxtaposition of, I mean, and again, this is clearly what Wright was going for. That really stands out.
Okay, Joan, it's Tom at the bar. Through the
The other thing that came to mind was, and I don't really know where Mulholland Drive fits into, whether it's a thriller or a horror film. I mean, obviously it has components of both, but it has this really pivotal stage performance of Roy Orbison's Crying, but done in Espanol, by Rebecca Del Rio, that happens at a really key plot point in the film. And I know the word haunting gets used, probably overused, but there's no better way of describing that.
Yo estaba bien por un tiempo volviendo a sonreír. Luego anoche te vi, tu mano me tocó y el saludo de tu voz.
How about you, Renee? What jumps to your mind?
I was thinking about, have you seen Jennifer's Body?
I have not, but I've heard of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it came out, 10 years ago, directed by Karen Kusama, starring my queen, Megan Fox, and she ate that performance up. But regardless of that, you know, part of the plot is that there's this band that she likes and that she is swooned by, and they play this song called Through the Trees at the bar that ends up burning down. And, you know, throughout the plot, this song is brought into the movie. It becomes like the high school's theme song throughout the tragedy of the movie. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone. You should go see it. But at the end of the movie, you know, it all comes together that this band is who killed Jennifer. And you kind of like watch them do it through some trees in the forest. And the song is called Through the Trees. And it's like, it's such a kind of a vile scene, what they do to Megan Fox in that movie, that the song is so chilling. But, you know, having come out at the end of the 2000s, it was very just this, like, 2000s little boy band vibe of a song, you know?
Good evening, Devil's Lake.
Devil's Cattle!
Fucking A right it is.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Renee Beaver on Us after a brief word from a couple of great Max Fun podcasts. Don't go anywhere.
Hey everyone, Jean Zulfikari here with the cast of Mission to Zix.
Hello.
Our fourth season premieres on February 19th, and for those of you who aren't familiar with the show, we decided to ask one of our characters to give you a quick recap of what's happened so far, so say hi,
C-53. Hello, how may I be of service?
C, could you tell us what's happening in the Zix Quadrant leading up to Season 4?
Certainly. The evil Nerd Bundeloy, not to be confused with the non-evil Nerd Bundeloy of no relation, murdered his fellow counselors and crowned himself Emperor of the Galaxy, with the help of myself and the rest of the crew. of the Bartarian Jade, Zemanite Plectic Center Nut, the Emperor, and an ancient cosmic entity known as Bino, into a chasm aboard the gigantic Planet Crusher Crusher, a machine built to crush planet crushers, which in turn were designed to crush planets. The resulting implosion created a vast celestial object with unknown powers. We are currently in search of our former rebel commander, Sisu Gundu, who may yet reunite our fractured galaxy. Is that sufficient?
Yeah, all clear to me. Mission to Zix, Season 4, debuts on February 19th on Maximum Fun.
Hey, I'm Jared Hill, co-host of the brand new Maximum Fun podcast, Fan Time.
And I'm Travell Anderson. I'm the other more fabulous co-host. And the reason you really should be tuning in.
I feel the nausea rising.
To be Fan Time is to be a big fan of something, but also have some challenging or anti feelings toward it.
Kind of like Kanye.
We're all fans of Kanye. He's a musical genius, but like, you know.
He thinks slavery is a choice.
Or like the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Like, I love the drama, but do I want to see black women fighting each other on screen?
Ew. To the nah.
We're tackling all of those complex and complicated conversations about the people, places, and things that we love.
Even though they may not love us back.
Fanti, Maximum Fun, podcast.
Ow.
We are back on Heat Rocks. This is part of our Music and Popcorn series. We're talking about Jordan Peele's 2019 film, Us and Its Music, mm-hmm. with guest Renee Beaver.
I want to talk about the drive in the car on the way to the beach, because when the trailer came out, I love social media. You know, it's a love-hate thing, but mostly I love it. But I love Black Twitter and what mm-hmm. they go in on. And so the whole debate about the car ride was Lupita Nyong'o on beat when she was snapping her fingers? Okay. And that was like a 3-day old, you know what I'm saying? This was like prolific arguments happening on social media. Like, right. Was she on beat? Okay. And so then film Twitter, Black film Twitter had to weigh in like, well, you don't know what happened, you know, when we're filming trailers and the timing might have been off. Then we got into playbacks and what happens, and then music supervisors weighed in and whatever.
That's hilarious.
So that became the thing.
What is I Got Five on me?
It's about drugs.
It's not about drugs. It's a dope song. Don't do drugs.
Jason, come on. Yeah. Get in rhythm. There you go.
In my mind, because I'm a music supervisor and because I see clips in their first, second, third iteration and cuts. At the time the playback was available, maybe the song wasn't cleared yet and they just had her snap to an invisible beat. Mm-hmm. And by the time the song was cleared, it just didn't work out in timing. What did you think? Did you think deeply about it? Did you think she was on beat?
I don't think I noticed, but okay. Now that I think about it, now I know why, but she always did seem so strange to me. And I don't think it would have stood out to me that she was off beat.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, so because I had seen all this stuff on Twitter previous to having seen the film, I was waiting for the scene and I'm paying close attention. I think the answer is she's kind of on and she's kind of off. Like there's
sure.
points where she is on, but not the whole way through. And
right.
I think Renee, like you, I was trying to figure out, is this supposed to be a character indication, right? That
yeah.
something's off. Or to your point, Morgan, is it just, you know, the editing was, there's only so much that you can do.
There's only so much you can do.
Fix it. I think the fact that it's ambiguous is actually kind of the charm of it regardless, is because
sure.
of the fact that you can have this argument. And if you want to read it from a narrative point of view, if you want to read it from a technical point of view, it works either way.
It works, because if she's some sort of doppelganger,
right.
if she's not the real Lupita, then she's off.
I think what this means, though, is any future film where a character is expected to snap their fingers or clap their hands on beat, they're going to be – that actor is going to be super mm-hmm. nervous about this.
Super nervous. They're going to be like, yo, get this on. And sometimes this happens. Like the scene is recorded before you have a song. And this has happened to me before where they've put in a song temporarily and for whatever reason we can't
right.
hear that song,
yeah.
we can't afford it.
Right.
So one of the things that we have to do as music supervisors is you have to match up the timing.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to count the BPMs on whatever we have in mind so that the beat matches their steps. And sometimes that's difficult. I did this for an episode of Queen Sugar and I had to watch them dance over and over and over again. And then I put in a song. Oh, yeah. So shout out to Lupita, because I'm not going to judge you, sister. You might have been on... You know what I mean? I'm on your side, Lupita. I'm with you.
She should
this.
Be mad if she got done dirty, though, you know, if it was a production issue.
You know? Well, then, you know, then cultural critic Black Twitter came in and was like, why is this a thing? Why is this a discussion? There's a larger issue. About class, race, people were like, but was she on beat, though?
I love that, you know, I'm glad you reminded me that she had told her son to, like, catch the beat.
Catch the beat.
As the doppelganger, like, as the tethered person, it's like she knows how to mimic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like that is advice that she would give.
Get the beat.
Know? Yeah.
Get the beat. Yeah.
So, Morgan, as a music supervisor, what did you think about the overall song choices and placements in the film?
Love them. Because, and I have to go back to Thomas Golubich again, because when I first started doing this, I thought, you know, yo, what's some advice you could give a young music supervisor? And the two things he said was, one, listen to everything. Mm. And two, make elegant choices. And by elegant, I didn't know at the time, but I understood later as watching his career. I mean, he is a music supervisor, and one of the best in the business. But what he's best at is making surprising choices, which is, it's tempting to always go on the nose, and sometimes that's appropriate, but putting things that you wouldn't expect. And they could have played anything in the car. They could have gone current in the car. But to come back to, well, first Janelle Monáe, which I loved, which I thought is really pretty and elegant. It sort of set the tone to what Jordan Peele thinks about soft voices. Mm. Because you start with Janelle and you end with Minnie Riperton. We can talk about that a little bit later.
Mm. I didn't think about that. Yeah, great point.
His thing about soft voices, which I don't want to get too deep into it, but I think sometimes if you think about soft voices, what they do for your mind, that they lull you into a false sense of security, and that whole, what is it, AMSR? ASMR?
ASMR, yeah, ASMR.
Soft voices, what they do. And the extremes that they take you to, sometimes they can drive you crazy, but sometimes they lull you into everything is going to be okay.
Absolutely.
And at the strangest times in Jordan Peele's movies, you got a soft voice. So I like that he was doing something, I thought psychologically, that we weren't aware of.
Well, first, I really love what you're saying about soft voices, because soft voices, they're actually capable of making you feel any emotion as opposed to like a scream or a yell, because you can feel relaxation or you can feel terror.
Yeah.
And I think that is the creepiest part about it to me, is because maybe in the beginning of a statement, you don't know which way it's going to go, but you definitely know by the end.
You definitely know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it was just so... It was so refreshing to hear something with a good beat in a horror movie.
Yeah.
If something familiar, something fun, but something that, you know, really got flipped on its head when we're talking about the Loonies. Like, when that song comes on, what you imagine is probably not a scary situation.
Right.
Or a time in history that you didn't enjoy.
Sure.
But just... I mean, and the way that Abel's like recomposed that and added in all of these really just kind of like breathtaking, scary elements, it's just so genius. I'm like, don't throw a violin on top of a hip hop beat. Like, I will lose my mind.
Right.
I will lose it. It was just so special. And I think, I don't know, sometimes I feel like something with that excellent of a beat, it's like a dog whistle. It was like a dog whistle for black folks when we started to watch that movie. Like, oh, is this for us?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
This is a super duper nitpick point.
Go in.
Because I was living in the Bay Area when that song dropped. What I really wanted to hear, I wanted to hear the remix. which would not have changed it musically. It just would have been, you know, all the baller, the big baller remix of all the top Oakland and Bay Area MCs.
Indeed.
At the time. Because that was the version that really got the heaviest play, at least in the Bay Area, for perhaps obvious reasons. And it's really the version I know best. It actually was listening to them playing the Loonies in the car. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is what the OG version sounds like. But I never hear this version.
Sure.
I always hear the remix. E-40, why you treat me so bad? 40 makes it happen. Fosgate slacking, revenue growth, and just a little bit of lightweight. Flamboats and potent fumes linger. Mighty clouds and northern lights. I respect the victor bearing, and you'll be violating my civil rights. I'm starting to feel my skrill, but perhaps today my skrill ain't... This is all besides the point. I think again, we've been giving credit here to composer Michael Abels, who
Indeed.
He created the so-called tethered mix for I Got Five on It, and taking all of the elements that you never really realized were that creepy in the original song, because
right.
that's not what the song was about.
Yes.
But then hearing that and then really pulling it out, which is, I think, the point that both of you are making here.
When you had add an echo to it
yes. right.
and overdub it a whole bunch of times,
yeah.
and you know, chop yeah. and screw it, you're like, well, damn.
I'm just glad the Loonies are getting paid.
Yeah,
you
right.
know, in the late 20 teens, like that's
it was a whole
nice.
Odyssey of rights and publishing and stuff, and so I'm glad. And to have the song used again, because it was also used in The Last Black Man in San Francisco, but it actually has the lead singer.
Interesting.
And he plays sort of a busker,
yeah.
and he's singing I Got Five. So that's another placement.
Yeah.
So that's another paycheck. Yeah. Shout out.
Normally on our conventional show, we would ask people what the fire track is off of the album. But in this case, the fire track equivalent for our discussion here on Music and Popcorn would be, what was your favorite use of a pop song in the movie that we're talking about? So in Us, what do you think was the singular best use of a pop song?
I love N.W.A.
Kind of hard to go wrong.
I love it.
Oh, my God.
I'm from L.A. This is my hometown. But I like the spirit and the timing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you think back to the scene, this is so smart. Like, shout out to Jordan Peele, damn it. But it's so smart about the difference between what is scary to black people and what is scary to white people.
Mm-hmm.
When Lupita and family are in the house and she hears a knock at the door, everybody's instantly scared. And they're like, get the bat, okay? Something's about to go down. The white family, the wife says, I heard something at the door. And he's like, oh, I'm chilling. Remember, he's in his chair. He's drinking. It's not scary to him. That noise outside is like whatever. And then he makes the joke and says,
oh, shit. No. Yeah, there's something out there.
Don't fuck with me, Josh.
I'm not fucking with you. I'm serious. There's something out there. Look. Look behind the car.
Where? I don't see it.
By the car.
I
look.
Can't...
Oh, shit.
What?
Oh, my God. It's O.J. That's O.J. Simpson.
What is wrong with you?
And we know that the O.J. trial and all the brouhaha around it had a lot of racial politics mm-hmm. and policies behind it. So I thought that was smart. And then the timing of the police is right when she says, call the police.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a twist on, it's like not the police. The police have said, f*** you, because you're getting ready to get killed by your doppelganger. And Alexa, who just doesn't,
Ophelia,
mm-hmm. who's different on this side of town. When
right.
you cry for help, she's like, we're going to put on N.W.A. Which was also surprising. Like, why is that in your playlist? But okay.
Why stop? Stopping Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. Ophelia, call the police. Sure. Playing Fuck the Police by N.W.A.
Coming straight from the underground. The young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk.
At the moment of your greatest, you are completely incapacitated. You are crawling on the floor. And somebody that looks just like your husband is about to slash you up. And you cry out for the police. And here comes N.W.A. And that's it for you.
It's just like so genius going from the Beach Boys,
which
is what was playing
right,
previously.
Right, the whitest of all white.
The whitest of all white.
Still West Coast.
Still West Coast.
Still West Coast.
Great song. I would never be smirched the Beach Boys.
Sure.
Let alone Good Vibrations. But anyways.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bop, you know. But
yeah.
I'm like,
yeah.
I definitely knew. I was like, oh, I think this is a bop because I was raised by white women.
Sure.
Who thought this was a bop.
Sure.
You know? And so it's, I love the switch. And I love that. It's just a reminder of, it was kind of a slap in the face. I mean, it is a slap in the face, obviously, that she asks for the police to be called and then the song gets played. But also it's a slap in the face to just remind everyone that not everyone can call the police.
Right.
And expect to be saved from anything.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? And so I love that. And I didn't think about it being in their playlist. I just thought it was like,
whatever, yeah.
You know, it sure. utilizing the internet.
Just,
yeah.
Right.
Sure.
But it is funnier thinking about it being on their playlist.
Right.
Because I'm like, oh, you thought that song was real cute, huh?
Exactly.
Right. And you're someone who calls the police for help.
That's right. But no.
Yeah.
Not this time. And then also, too, about that scene that was so scary is when I said earlier about the elements of horror movies that he employs, and to me, nothing was scarier, more scary about The Shining than those twins.
Ooh, yes.
So having twins in this film, I was like, yep, somebody's going to die in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the chaos of that situation, I was almost shocked when that happened because I didn't know it was going to go down like that. But that has a lot to do with the music.
Right.
The music is playing.
Right. Good vibrations.
Relaxed.
Yeah. It's a feel-good song. Everyone's lulled into a sense of security.
That's
and all of a sudden the scissors come out and then it's game over.
The twins are being bratty.
Yep.
They're like, go to bed. And they're like,
we're not even asleep.
We're not even sleeping. And then they get popped so quick. I didn't know everyone else was going to have a doppelganger.
Right.
You know,
right. We didn't know that.
Right. And
that.
It happened so fast. And then you see them laying in the hallway, just like the twins from The Shining.
Just like.
And it was just stunning. Like, I got deep chills because I was like, oh, you did that.
Blood on the wall, Stanley Kubrick, over again. Here we go.
Two thoughts about specifically the use of fuck the police in that scene. One is I was reading that according to the person who runs the music department at Universal, which did all the clearances for this, they'd actually tested that scene with the police, meaning like Sting and Company. And they tried both ways. And he didn't say which police song, but I think the thinking was it was probably Every Breath You Take because Elizabeth Moss's character is about to take her last one.
Yeah.
And I think probably, perhaps not surprisingly, even though it would have been very funny to hear the police come on, it just wasn't. It's not going to play the same way as Fuck the Police is. And the other thing, and we talked about this in the Wong Kar-wai episode where we're talking about Chungking Express, about that certain filmmakers really let the songs play, not just for like that 20 seconds, but they let the song play. And this was a case where Fuck the Police, I think, maybe even longer than the Loonies, is maybe it's not the full length of the song, but it's at least a good 2 to 3 minutes.
Sure.
Which means that you get to hear it as Zora's going around in the house with that golf putter putting in work on the zombie twins. And something about just the energy of Fuck the Police, and you're watching, you know, this black teenager going around taking out fools. Again, I don't think it was a coincidence. I think it's completely deliberate because there is a kind of exuberance there. My daughter was getting hyped watching her just straight up taking shots of the dome on the zombie twins.
I didn't even think about the timing of that. Now I have to revisit that.
Right, because he could have just ended it after Moss's character dies. Mm-hmm. But instead, that song is still playing 2-3 scenes into that segment.
I'm tired of the motherfucking jacking. Sweating my gang while I'm chilling in the shack and shining the light in my face, and for what? Maybe it's because I kick so much, but I kick ass. Or maybe because I blast on a stupid ass nigga when I'm playing with the trigger of an Uzi or an AK.
And that is a genius use of a song carrying the narrative. It also says to me their music budget was right. That's what it says to me.
Well, hey, they're clearing Good Vibrations.
Oh, yeah.
You figured they got some money. Yeah.
But one of the people that I went was with a music supervisor, and we tease each other all the time because we're like, let's let this be the film that we're not counting dollars, because it's hard not to do that because we clear stuff all the time.
Right.
But as soon as that came on, I was already like $60,000, $70,000, blah, 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 blah. You're going in your mind because those are big, big uses.
Right.
But also there wasn't a lot of music in there, so he could stretch his dollars a little bit more.
Yeah. So besides the NWA, any other favorite moments of pop placement in this film?
At the end, when Minnie Riperton starts, it was I love Rob Zombie. I love Rob Zombie films. And it was giving me like Devil's Reject, like just major release and relief. And it just played so well with the sunshine and seeing people joined in the hands across the terrain. And it was just the perfect song to express a shift and to express relief and release.
Lead me through a dream for all of these simple things and much more. A flower was born, it blooms to spread love and joy.
Biased because I love Minnie Riperton. I thought it was such a flip to your point on Hands Across America and how we started. As it ended, we floated. The cinematography, we floated over that space. Mm-hmm. And Minnie Riperton helped us to float.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfection. Made me want to go home and practice.
We've been talking a little bit about Michael Abels and the music that he did for it. This, is the second time that he's worked with Jordan Peele.
Sure.
I think, you know, no less an authority on this. And it was either George Lucas or Steven Spielberg basically told Peele that you and Abels are like the new, like, Lucas and John Williams, like the way in which your work goes together so well.
Sure.
And for those unfamiliar with the backstory of how the two men begin working together, it's when Peele was making Get Out, he specifically wanted to find an African-American composer. And because that particular industry, at least here in Southern California, is not the most diverse, shall we say, he had a really hard time. I think he found Abels because Abels had posted some stuff on YouTube of some of the work that he had done.
Sure.
Because Abels wasn't getting work from a lot of these studios, and that's kind of how they found each other. I mean, even though our segment is really focusing primarily on the pop music, I think it would be a disservice not to give Abels more credit for the score. I mean, besides the tethered mix of the Looney's joint, I mean, there's one scene which is rather long, and I think it might be the longest time outside of maybe the intro or outro where we hear one of his score songs play. The song's called Femme Fatale, and it's when the shadow version of Elizabeth Moss, who I think is called Dahlia, the shadow version is called Dahlia, is putting on lipstick.
Ooh.
And it's creepy as fuck. But Femme Fatale is playing behind it. And the first thing I thought about, and I was trying to figure out if this was purposeful. I can't imagine it wasn't. It sounds very much like Abel's take on Henry Mancini's Lujan, which has been placed in quite a few films. Lujan is amazing, and I think what Abels does here and the way it underscores this really creepy thing of this, you know, the shadow zombie putting lipstick on, I thought worked beautifully. I mean, hearing this again, it's definitely Lujan. There's no way this is not his riff on that. But in any case, it's the one. There might have been other instances of the score not being super creepy or tense, but this is one where it's not that at all. I mean, it's beautiful. It feels nice. But the visual on the screen is that kind of ambivalence. Well, she's having a nice little moment here, except it's really fucked up,
right?
You know, given what we've just seen from that.
Right.
Ugh, I loved that moment because I imagined that all of the tethered people underground are so used to mimicking their doppelganger in that moment she's like, I have done this before. I've made this motion to, like, put something on, and now I understand what was actually happening because this time there's actually lip gloss in my hands.
Right.
And her eyes in that shot are just, she looks mesmerized and so happy. And then with that score behind it, it's obviously startlingly creepy, but I almost forgot.
Right.
That it was scary because I was almost happy
for the
person.
Yeah.
Right.
I was like, oh, thank God you're not underground anymore and you know, you get to, like, put on lip gloss if that's what you want to do.
And then not.
And then not. And then not at all.
And then not. And I would be remiss if I didn't take a moment to shout out the community of Black composers, which include Terrence Blanchard and Chris Bowers and Daniel Crawford, alongside Catherine Bostick, Tamara Colley, Tara Stinson. So I just wanted Emma Shalindegi Ocello. So we are out here doing it, but it's wonderful that that Jordan was able to find Michael Abels, and shout out to them putting in the work.
Yeah. Renee, if you had to describe us in three words, what would those three words be?
I would say that it's poignant and chilling, but refreshing at the same time. And I don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
I got five on it. if our listeners, those who have already seen us or those who have are intrigued now to go watch it, what should be the next thing they watch after this, Renee?
It seems like an odd recommendation because some of it feels so opposite of us, but I really think they should watch The Devil's Rejects.
Mm.
And I think, you know, as us is so beautiful in spite of the carnage or whatever is terrifying, and The Devil's Rejects is ugly. And I think you can feel the beauty from Us and the ugliness from Devil's Rejects really intensely if you watch them near each other.
Morgan, you have any thoughts?
I'd go back, and only because I think that it was a horror movie, cheesy horror, but if you go back to 1987 and The Lost Boys.
I was just thinking
that. Oh, my
that.
God. I was thinking about The Lost Boys yeah. and the music.
Because they had a great soundtrack.
And wasn't that also set in Santa Cruz?
Yes.
Set in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
On the beach.
Suburbs.
The You're so smart. That is exactly what people should watch.
Yep. The two Corys.
The two okay. Corys.
Right?
My dude Kiefer. Jason
yes.
Patrick, when Jason Patrick was still a thing, he was actually never really a thing, but they tried to make him a thing.
They did try to make,
they
him.
Did try to make him a thing.
Yeah, great hair. And there is a scene, like we were saying earlier, when you have a song where little kids are singing,
mm-hmm.
somebody's going to die. So get into the soundtrack and go back to 1987 and The Lost Boys. That would be my recommendation.
Perfect. That was perfect.
Yeah, Lost Boys.
I'm going to go with low-hanging fruit, which is The Shining. And partly it's because there's been so much discussion around Kubrick's film because Dr. Sleep, at the time that we're recording this, Dr. Sleep had just come out a couple weeks ago, apparently has flopped really badly, but we don't need to get into that. But if you want to talk about just a sense of both visual and sonic atmosphere, I mean, The Shining is at the pinnacle in terms of that, especially on the visual level. And as we were talking about, it's, you know, Peele clearly is riffing on parts of that, especially with the twins, and I'm sure there's other little things that you can find, little Easter eggs planted there. But
indeed.
If you've never seen The Shining, it's not the kind of consistent it's not a horror fest in I think some of the more traditional ways we've come to think of it, but it is similar to Us. Is once that creepiness sets in, and really with that film, it sets in on the drive into the hotel,
yes.
which now I think about it. What does Us open with? It opens with a drive through the woods.
Yes.
So again, another echo. And that atmosphere just does not let up throughout the entirety of that film. So,
So true.
And in both films, something's amiss with the little boy.
Yes.
Yes.
There,
that too.
Something's amiss with the little boy.
There you go.
That'll do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our guest, Renee Beaver, talking about the very cool movie, which was Us, and the ultra cool soundtrack. Let us know what's going on with you now and where can folks find you.
I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Black Cupcake. It's BlackCupcake. I co-host a podcast that we mentioned earlier called Attack of the Queer Wolf. And you can find us wherever you stream your podcasts. And we're also on Instagram and Twitter at Queer Wolf Pod.
And get into her socials because I live for them. So please do get into her Instagram. The posts give me such life.
And to be clear, Attack of the Queer Wolf is it's a horror
yes.
film podcast. So
yes.
The three of you discuss different horror films.
Yes. So there's three of us, and we discuss horror movies from a queer perspective.
Love it.
And you're named after the film Curse of the
yes.
Queer Wolf, right?
Yeah.
Which I've never seen. Was that part of your discussion? Have you all discussed that film?
We haven't yet, actually. I think we're just, you know, you kind of wait for the right guest and the right timing.
Oh, we know how
but
that works.
Yeah, you know, but it'll definitely happen.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Max Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles, where you might actually run into your doppelganger. You never know. It's that kind of neighborhood.
All right. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Heat Rocks Pod. You can find a link to our Facebook group on our webpage, heatrockspod.com. That's where we'll post show notes for every episode, including a full transcript of each episode, a track listing of everything you've heard today, and other goodies. Again, that's at heatrockspod.com.
We want to thank all of our 5-star iTunes reviewers, including, and Morgan, you'll like this, Lineage of Combustibles,
yeah.
who wrote in to say that Morgan and I are, quote, five-star generals, unquote, with, quote, 10 degrees of style, unquote. Damn, that deserves a 20-gun salute. Thank you, Lineage of Combustibles. Likewise, shout out to Steve B. EC, who, quote, swoons at Morgan's intros, unquote, while enjoying my, quote, erudite, heartfelt, and insightful reflections, unquote. That is such nice reviews that
Man.
We've gotten. If folks have not had a chance yet, please do consider leaving us a short review on iTunes, because it is a key way that new listeners can find their way to us.
We also wanted to thank all of our social media fans out there and our family, including the following. We want to thank Don't Call Me Shirley. Thank you so much. We want to thank at Jazz Tahara. We want to thank Keith the Gooner. Thank you so much, Keith. We want to thank Scolero Patera. Okay. Shout out to you. We also want to thank Jacoby 81. Thank you for holding us down. Jacoby's always in the game. Misty Create. Thank you for holding us down. We also want to thank Diego Martinez, Courtney at Cahortney. Okay, cool. Someone who shouts out Auntie Aunting. Okay, thank you so much, Auntie. We want to thank Dan Jidey. We want to thank Johnny California. Salute. Want to thank Dirty Pop, Granger Boy, Shibuya Knights. We also want to thank Peeping in My Window. We do so appreciate the Tweezies and the Retweezies. Good to see you, Oliver.
Good to see you too, Morgan. And one last thing. Here is a teaser for next week's episode, the next installment in the Music and Popcorn series, featuring The Ringer's own podcaster and movie writer, Sean Fennessy, talking with us about the 1992 film by Ernest Dickerson, Juice. Juice doesn't really fit in, I think, easily to any of these other films that have a lot in common with each other in some ways, but this one, and partly it's because of what they decide to do with Bishop and his character that I feel like really takes it in a completely different direction in some ways.
I agree with you. I think that's really astute. I don't know why that is. I don't know what it is about this dynamic. Dickerson did not write a lot of his own movies, but he did have the story by credit and a co-screenwriting credit.
Yeah,
on
I noticed
this movie.
That, right.
And even in talking to people before we did this, a lot of them pointed out to me that he really did not write a lot of other films going forward. He goes on to make a couple of more movies inside of the studio system. And then, as you mentioned, he essentially works in television now.
Right.
He very rarely makes feature films now. There's a part of me that wishes he wrote more of his own work. And I would have liked to have seen what those movies were like, because he is older than these characters, but he does seem to have a genuine understanding of where these characters are coming from.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.